Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome back to Year in Review. As today we talk about the management of non-Hodgkin lymphoma. We have a great faculty, Dr. Stephen Ansell from the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, and Dr. Brian Hill from the Cleveland Clinic Tulsa Cancer Institute in Cleveland. Today we're here to talk about non-Hodgkin lymphoma. And as in all of our programs, there will be mentions of the use of non-approved agents and regimens. So check out the package inserts for more specific information. So as we do in all of our year in review programs, I meet with the faculty individually prior to this webinar. And I met with both of our faculty in the last week to record a presentation. And today we're going to sort of take some of the slides from their presentations and go into more depth about it. But this really is a year in review, a comprehensive review of many different papers. They're posted in the chat room, and we'll send out a notice when this program's available. You can check it out there as well. But this is really a comprehensive review of a lot of papers and presentations. What we're going to try to do today is get into some of the clinical implications moving forward. And here's some of the topics that we're going to go through today. Particularly, we're going to focus on diffuse large B-cell, mantle cell, and follicular, and a few other relevant topics. So before we kind of start talking about data, incidentally, we just got back from the Oncology Nursing Society meeting. We always go there. This is the 17th year we've gone to ONS, and we did 11 programs there. But I just want to point out, we did an entire program at ONS on bispecifics in small cell lung cancer. So we're going to talk about this in NHL, but this is a pretty interesting experience and hearing about patients treated with a CD3 bispecific who have small cell, of course, a very different patient population from non-Hodgkin lymphoma, and really interesting to see these agents starting to come into practice in the community. So this is a question we actually asked to the audience as part of the pre-meeting survey. And I'd like to know, I want you to kind of predict, Steve, we said, here's the situation. You got a patient with follicular lymphoma. They're getting BR, typical first line treatment. Then they get second line R squared, and a decision has been made to use mosunetuzumab. And what I wanted to know from the audience is, how in their practice, how would a patient typically get mosunetuzumab? Would they start the therapy themselves, or would they send a patient to a tertiary center who would start and send back to them, or would the tertiary specialists keep it? Steve, the reason I brought this up is I keep hearing investigators saying that mosunetuzumab is really well tolerated. It's only given for a shorter period of time, and that it should at some point be something that could be given in community-based practice. Do you think that time is now, Steve, or we need to wait a little bit?
So I certainly would hope that the time was now, but I think, to be honest, I would predict that the answer might be number three here, where partnering up with a tertiary specialist to start in the ramp up and get the tolerability worked out, because subsequent doses would actually be well tolerated and then the patient would be transferred back to a community practice. But if I was to cast my mind 6 to 12 months down the road, that may be different, and I think there'll be more and more familiarity with this treatment and more people likely to manage it in their practice.
Brian, any thoughts? I guess one of the issues, even though this agent and the bispecific in general seem to be very well tolerated, but you can see cytokine release syndrome. And I guess one of the issues is that most community-based general medical oncology practices don't carry tocilizumab. Do you think that's necessary in order to give these agents, Brian? Is it okay if there's a tertiary center nearby with an ER that carries it? Any thoughts? And what is the likelihood that a patient on, for example, mosunetuzumab is going to have a serious problem with, for example, CRS or even ICANS?
Yes, these are great questions. I think that mosunetuzumab is well tolerated. It's all outpatient therapy. There's this prescribed ramp up, and there's pretty good guidance about what to do in the event of fever or fever with sort of hemodynamic or pulmonary instability. And you know what I think the key thing is that if you're going to be starting these, you kind of have to have a plan ahead of time of what are you going to do if there is a fever and it's, you know, after hours in particular. Even if the oncology clinic stocks the tocilizumab, you know, how are you going to get that to the patient on nights and weekends? If you have an emergency department that's in your practice or referral network, how are you going to communicate, especially after hours, if these things happen? So to answer your question, the rates are low, and you can certainly temporize people with steroids before giving tocilizumab. And the likelihood of having really a high-grade CRS, I think, is it's not zero, but it is probably less than 5%. This is something that will probably evolve over time.
So, Steve, I know we're going to talk later, but there are trials now actually looking at bispecifics up front, even combined with chemoimmunotherapy. What do you see in terms of, again, CRS and neurotoxicity when you add in, you know, chemotherapy, for example?
So that's actually really interesting. And certainly if you use an antibody drug conjugate or if you use chemotherapy with a bispecific antibody, some of those side effect profiles actually become less of a concern, particularly some of the CRS type symptoms and the like. So actually, I think when you are using additional, shall we say, cytotoxic agents, that may actually make administration a little easier. I think one of the challenges is that other toxicities may become a little bit more of a challenge, including, let's say, problems with infectious complications because of the fact that you are really effectively depleting B cells particularly.
So we all predicted that everybody would say three, but it's actually a lot of people are saying they would start therapy themselves. So I don't know, maybe our group is a little bit ahead of most other general medical oncologists, but that's what they said. Interesting. We have to pursue that a little more and see whether that's being reproduced. All right, so let's go through some of the papers that you talked about. We're going to begin with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And Steve, you talked about the update that we saw at ASH of the POLARIX study using Pola-R-CHP, and that the benefit now has continued to be maintained over 5 years. In your talk, you go through all the discussion about cell of origin and the question of, does everybody benefit? Do people benefit better who have ABC? There was some more data that came out that they included there from a global population. But so just to kind of take the temperature in terms of the two of you, I'll start with you, Brian. First of all, can a doc in practice who's getting a cell of origin study through IHC depend upon it? And are you more likely to use Pola-R-CHP in a patient who has non-germinal? Do you think it's also effective in a patient with germinal cell and should be considered there? Do you think tolerability or toxicity is any different, Brian?
Yeah, great question. So the study was designed and pre-specified for all comers, and that's where the benefit was small but significant in all comers. And in this study and in a prior randomized trial in the relapse setting where Pola was combined with BR, there is a pretty strong signal that the benefit of polatuzumab vedotin is primarily in the activated B-cell subtype patients. ABC or gene expression typing is something that is not routinely done in clinical practice. The tests are cumbersome and sort of send-outs. But the best proxy we have is the Hans algorithm immunohistochemistry testing, which is pretty reliable and reasonably accurate. And I think at this last ASH meeting, there was some real-world sort of data suggesting that Hans algorithm may be adequate enough. But to answer your question, in our practice, we're really kind of sticking with the labeled indication, which is for sort of intermediate to high risk IPI score 2 to 5 diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. Where you're using polatuzumab with RCHP because of the labeled indication, the approval are for that subset of patients. And to answer your question about toxicity, the febrile neutropenia rate and myelosuppression looks pretty comparable. The neurotoxicity or peripheral neuropathy you see when you swap the vincristine out and insert polatuzumab is pretty similar. So that's kind of where we've landed, is sticking with the label.
So, Steve, what about older patients? You know, in the past, we've used R-mini-CHOP. Should R-mini, you know, POLA R-CHIP be considered with a mini-CHOP? Generally, how do you approach patients, Steve, that you feel can't really handle full-dose treatment?
Yeah, so I would just say that, you know, the original R-CHOP trials were actually done in those over 65. So where they showed that R-CHOP was superior to CHOP chemotherapy was actually in two elderly populations. Now, clearly, elderly is one thing. Fragile is a different thing. So I think a lot of this is around not chronological age, but biological age. So if you're a fragile patient, I think that does speak to whether you should be getting a full-dose treatment. I think our mini CHOP has been a go-to. There's not been a lot of data around a mini POLA R-CHIP, but I think there are some data that suggests that that's feasible. I think the other thing that we've done in some patients is just do a POLA R-CHIP, but omit the doxorubicin as a way to utilize that regimen. However, I would say that whatever you do to modify the regimen, you have to modify your expectations for outcome, because clearly you're leaving out key ingredients of the regimen that would help with good responses.
Brian, any thoughts about whether in the next few years we're going to see patients getting CAR T in this situation, maybe who wouldn't be eligible for R-CHOP?
Yeah, I'm not sure about frontline CAR T for the R-CHOP ineligible, but what I do think is going to be moving to the frontline will be, again, anthracycline omitted regimens. Maybe we use rituximab with polatuzumab, for instance, a bispecific. Even though those are so-called chemotherapy-free, I think for the fragile elderly, they still may pose some significant toxicity challenges. So this group of patients is out there, the kind of 80 to 90-year-olds or the frail 70-year-olds, and they're really not adequately met. Their needs are not being adequately met by currently available approaches. So it is fertile ground.
So this is a slide that Steve showed, which he goes through in his talk, but just focusing on the red circle there, second and third line therapy, which is increasingly numbers of options available. And I want to get your take on some of the papers that Steve talked about. First, we'll get into CAR T and bispecifics in a second. But Steve, of course, we've had tafasitamab out there for diffuse large B cell for a while, particularly with lenalidomide, very good outcomes. Also, you talked about loncatuximab tyrosine. I call it Lonca-T. I think everybody calls it Lonca-T. Another antibody-drug conjugate. Very good results also. What have you observed, Steve, in terms of tolerability issues with Lonca-T?
So in general, the challenges sometimes are here is fluid retention, and sometimes additional steroid use can help to mitigate that. I think in general, this agent, particularly if effective, you can administer it for multiple cycles. Not quite as well tolerated, I think, as, for example, agents such as tafasitamab, but certainly, as I say, an option. I think one other comment to make is brentuximab vedotin in combination with chemotherapy was a bit of a surprise for its efficacy. But clearly, antibody drug conjugates in this space have actually been effective, provided you can continue to administer it before toxicities make it limiting.
And I know they're looking at combinations with Lonca-T as well. Brian, again, any clinical pearls about management of toxicity with Lonca-T? What's your experience?
Yeah, you really have to counsel patients on sun exposure. You know, even something as simple as driving, you know, with your arm, with the window down, your left arm getting really exposed. So that's one. Monitoring the liver function is important, and fluid accumulations can be mitigated by spironolactone, actually has been used in the studies and is quite effective.
So in a second, I'm going to ask how you might sequence these three initial things that we're talking about here. And Steve, this is a little bit of a surprise that happened at ASH. So bevedotin, in diffuse large B-cell, the so-called Echelons 3 study was presented. Interesting that the control arm was R-squared, but you certainly saw a benefit, including, I believe, a survival benefit as well. Any thoughts about this? Were you expecting this, Steve, and what's your take on it?
So I think the surprise was not necessarily that it was more effective. It was the overall survival advantage. I think that was more surprising than anything, because one thought that you would have other agents that would impact things in general. I think it does speak to the fact that this is a sick population of people where sometimes if disease progresses, there's not all that many options subsequently, and that might impact things. But I think we may not have been quite so surprised, because brentuximab vedotin as a single agent in this space was actually tested many years ago and showed about a 40% response rate. And interestingly, that was regardless as to whether there was expression of CD30 or not. So again, exactly how this is delivered to the cancer cell or whether it's just delivered to cells in the microenvironment, I think is somewhat unknown at this point.
So Brian, any comments on toxicity that is observed or that you would expect with this combination? It kind of seems like it's, I mean, R squared has its own issues and B vedotin has its own issues, as we know from Hodgkin's, et cetera, but they seem kind of like they're not the same toxicity. But any thoughts about how these two are going to play out clinically, Brian?
Yeah, my sort of concern with this is because it's a little late to the game and many patients are getting a different vedotin. You know, you're going to see people getting exposed to the same monomethyl ester E payload with polatuzumab vedotin. Are they then going to respond to this vedotin ADC? We really don't know that because the patient's in year. I think few, if any, had prior polatuzumab vedotin exposure.
Yeah, so there's, you know, all the ADC people always argue about, you know, why do people come resistant? Is it the target? Is it the payload? I guess it's kind of hard to determine that, but people usually like to switch things up a little bit. So, Steve, yeah, when you look at these three options, at least that we're talking about right now, maybe this may be a patient who's already had CAR bispecific, maybe even CAR T. How would you think about sequencing them, and what kind of patient for which agent, Steve?
So I think it's nice that we have lots of options. And I think if I think about my practice, for me, it's very much about what is the goal and where are we trying to go. So if we're trying to bridge to something where we're trying to get some degree of response, and in other words, a shorter course of treatment would be reasonable, I think the antibody drug conjugate or containing regimens are something that I would look to more. If, on the other hand, I'm hoping to get something I can give for a much longer period of time, I think tafasitamab and lenalidomide is a little better for a longer duration treatment, and that would be my preference and where I would look.
Brian?
Yeah, I agree with that, that I think you can't really go beyond 4 to 6 cycles of Lonca T, and also brentuximab, eventually you're likely to get some peripheral neuropathy. So, you know, the challenge with the tafasitamab lenalidomide combo is, you know, for the really refractory patients, it doesn't seem to work as well. So if it's a later relapse and an elder patient who you think this is their destination therapy, it is a second line approval and it's on guidelines to use in second line. So if you think they can tolerate the lenalidomide, I think it's a reasonable option.
So let's talk a little bit about bispecifics. Of course, there are three that are approved, two in diffuse large B-cell, epcoritamab and glofitamab. And Brian, this is a slide that you showed during your talk. You know, it's kind of tough for us out there in the real world to figure out when new classes of agents come in how to differentiate them, because usually they haven't been directly compared, so we have to indirectly compare them. But of course, the thing that really jumps out here, is at least in the way they were tested, and I'm not sure exactly why, but Brian, is the fact a question of duration of treatment. And so you have glofitamab with a specific duration of treatment for a year, whereas EPCO is indefinitely. Any thoughts about how that factors into your decision about choosing treatment, Brian? And why were these agents studied that way?
Yeah, I don't know why, and I don't think it's anything magical about the drugs. I think it was just the way the studies were written, you know, many years ago. And you know, the issue, I think, with bispecifics in the kind of real-world practice, you're looking at pretty heavily pretreated patients. You know, they've often had CAR-T or can't get to CAR-T. You're in your kind of third or fourth line. It's an aggressive disease. So to be honest, I'm not really worried about what's happening a year from now. I'm really worried about, can I get this patient into remission now? And then a year from now, if they happen to still be in remission, then we'll have a good problem to address. But you know, that being said, we are starting to see patients who've gotten into complete remissions and they've been on treatment for a year. And we don't know yet, you know, if it's safe to stop or not. And I think as we learn more about how these agents perform, these will be important questions.
Steve, how do you decide between these two agents?
So I think a lot of this comes down to familiarity or with an agent at an institution. I think sometimes you kind of just begin to pick your favorite, if you like. I think there is a benefit potentially for some for a subcutaneous approach versus the intravenous. There may be merit for that. But I think to the point about duration of treatment, there may be some merit to stopping from a perspective of allowing your immune system to recover a little bit. You know, endless treatment may make more in the way of risk for infections. And I think also when you get to a year, to what Brian was saying, patients, it's a good problem to have, but they're getting a little antsy where they sometimes start to say, how about could I stop? I'd love to take a break. So I do think you're going to see the indefinite therapy molecules be tested, and they are already in a defined period of time instead of indefinite.
So in his talk, Brian goes through some of the more recent data with epcoritamab as well as for glofitamab. I think everybody's familiar with the how these agents work. Anything you want to say, Brian, in terms of response at the end of treatment that you see with glofitamab? And also, you were talking about recovery, but immune recovery after seeing glofitamab stopped.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it was on the previous slide we show, like that at the 12-month mark when the treatment stops, there is, you know, some drop-off in that first between 12 and 24 months after stopping glofitamab. And, you know, even those in CR seem to be, there's some decay of remission. So that sort of suggests that you're not cured at that point, at least not all patients. But what is nice, as Steve points out, is that you do see, you know, pretty within 6 to 12, 24 months, you get B-cell recovery. And that's a concern with ongoing bispecific antibody therapy is the B-cell aplasia that comes with it and the infection risk.
So, Steve, Brian also talked about the idea of, as we were alluding to, combining bispecific with chemotherapy. And you talked about this paper looking at glofitamab with GemOx. Any comments on this? I guess one of the issues is it kind of gives you a little bit of a anti-tumor boost as you're ramping up the dose. But what are your thoughts about this, Steve?
So I think these are really encouraging results. You know, people have always been very concerned about, is it a good idea to do something in the way of chemotherapy at the same time as using a treatment that's trying to get an immunological effect? And I think this, again, just very clearly shows that it's beneficial to use the two together. And I think we're learning that T cells are actually quite quick in replenishing themselves. And actually, it may not be a bad thing to have targeted the cancer, which is sort of poisoning the patient's immune system, to allow some fresh T cells to show up, which may be immunologically more active.
So, Steve, Brian, you also talked about your own work. I like the title of this thing, The Real Bite Study. We see so many real-world outcomes data sets coming out in oncology. So helpful to see this. Can you comment on what you saw? And the thing that really struck me was this issue of CD20 status, which I'm not sure people have been focused on. Can you go through that, Brian?
Yeah. So this is a large center, 20 centers. We had over 200 patients, and we really just asked the question: what happens when patients get bispecifics in the real world? And, you know, one of the first things you could see on the left is that if they were known to be ineligible for the registrational clinical trials based on the published inclusion-exclusion criteria for the registrational trials. They did worse. But both of the trials for EPCO and GlowFit did require CD20 expression. And on this study, we did find that a number of patients had biopsies immediately prior to bispecific antibody therapy that did not demonstrate CD20 expression. And as you can see, their PFS and their overall survival actually was much worse. So I think that this does need to be on the radar screen of clinicians. We are familiar with CD20 loss due to the ubiquitous use of rituximab, often in multiple lines of therapy. It's recycled, and we know that the incidence of CD20 downregulation is somewhere around 15 or 20% of cases. So I think this is important. And then just one final data point, we were able to ask the centers that did next generation sequencing for those who had a TP53 mutation. The outcomes looked pretty good for this treatment that hadn't been sort of reported before. So it's encouraging to think that a mutation that we think of as conferring resistance to chemotherapy may not matter as much for immunotherapy.
Yeah, the TP53 data is really interesting. Steve, do you check CD20 levels? Do you think people should do that as a standard?
Well, to be honest, I think our pathologists very commonly have that in their biopsy analysis and IHC panel when they do an analysis of patients. So I think we get that report. But I do think based on this data and some other data that I think looks similar, I think it is important if you're going to pick a target and then not have the target present, I think you might consider other options.
A question from the chat room, Brian from Kamal. Relapse lymphoma with leptomeningeal disease. Any preference for EPCO versus glofitamab? And in general, how do you manage that situation, Brian?
Yeah, I mean, CNS relapse is always hard. I think if the patient can go through high-dose methotrexate or cytarabine or other blood-brain barrier-penetrating therapies or an auto transplant, that's kind of the preferred road to go down. In this study, we had, I think, five or six patients with CNS involvement, and none of them responded. So I don't, that's small numbers, but I think more to come on whether or not bispecifics can help patients in the situation.
So there wasn't a whole lot new, at least at ASH and CAR-T, Steve, but one thing that was interesting is a new unapproved CAR-T product, RAP-Captagene Autolusal, that was presented at ASH. And the thing that was really interesting there is apparently this is prepared in 2 days. So I'm just kind of curious, Steve, and this is just a phase two study, 88% response rate, very encouraging, typical profiles in terms of ICANS and CRS from what I can see. I guess this platform, I don't know how they do it, this two-day T-charge platform. How much of a problem is the delay, Steve, in terms of, particularly in terms of progression of disease? And any thoughts about this? And I guess there are other attempts to try to shorten this time.
Yeah, so I think there are two reasons to shorten the time. The one is obviously the delay to actually treating a patient. And if you have very aggressive disease relapse, the longer it takes, obviously the patient requires bridging treatment, and some of the bridging treatments are not always that favorable for the patient's outcome subsequently. And to be frank, the fact that you needed to give the bridging therapy is already a challenge. But the other thing that I think is interesting here is long time of stimulating the cell and making the CAR T cells actually induces more immune exhaustion. So one of the potential things here is that the short duration of developing a CAR T may actually allow that CAR T to be more immunologically younger or more healthy, if you like, which potentially could result in better results. And I think the results from this trial were actually quite good. Whether it's better than a standard CAR T, I think we still need to see.
Brian, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I agree that, you know, the manufacturing time is still, you know, a problem. And, you know, sometimes you don't find out for 2 weeks that actually there was a manufacturing failure. So if you have a manufacturing time of 2 days, you'll have your answer quickly, and you can move on if you need to make arrangements for a repeat leukapheresis, for instance.
So I didn't tell you this, Brian, but when you were presenting this next paper, I was thinking of when Harry met Sally, the scene when somebody else goes, I'll have some of that.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
When I heard you say this, I'm like, yeah, I'll have some of this.
I'll have what she's having or something.
So, wow. Yeah, I'll have what she's having. So tell me about AZD0486. Pretty interesting.
Yeah, I mean, again, it just shows the number of ways you can put together targets and mechanisms. So if CD19-directed CARs work, and if CD20-directed bispecifics work, why not make a CD19-directed bispecific? And that's what this is. So the step-up dosing should look familiar by now. This study was a phase one with multiple different cohorts and different step-up doses. But what we saw, this was the, I think this is the follicular lymphoma cases that really the waterfall plot was pretty remarkable overall response rate of 95%, CRs of 85%. So that's really eye-popping. And, you know, sometimes, you know, you don't know if that's going to hold up in future trials, but I'm aware that this is going to be further developed, hopefully very quickly.
So, again, Steve, any thoughts? And also the issue of, again, sequencing mechanisms of resistance. It seems, I mean, first of all, it's a great waterfall plot and great data, but it seems like, you know, logical that it'd be great to have a different target that you could switch to. Any thoughts about these data and where you think it might lead, Steve?
So I do think that's great to have another molecule. This one also, if I remember correctly, is interesting because it has a low affinity binding to CD3, which may actually decrease the CRS issue that we spoke about before. So that may also give it and maintaining the merit and the benefit of it. So I think that's an additional potential plus. To your point about sequencing, though, it's going to be a little challenging sometimes if someone's had a CAR T, whether going right after CD19 immediately post CAR T, particularly if it was a CD19 CAR T, is going to be your best strategy. But alternatively, if you've gone after a different target, this may be a very viable and very important thing to consider as subsequently. And then also, as we're learning in follicular and other diseases, we may hold CAR T cells a little more in reserve. So then this may be a good option earlier in the disease course.
So to be continued, but it seems quite interesting. Let's move on to one of my favorite topics in oncology, mantle cell lymphoma, particularly upfront treatment. And Steve, you went through the recent history of this. It seems like it's been for years, but actually a lot of this is in the past year, beginning with the famous or infamous triangle study. Steve, I think everybody in general has heard about this and the fact that really raised the question of whether transplant or even intensive chemotherapy is indicated, something that's been done for a long time in younger patients. Anything you want to say about this study and some of the talk you've heard about this study and what the impact has been from what you've been able to observe in your own practice and in your colleagues, Steve?
So I would say that this study has turned how we manage mantle cell lymphoma on its head. You know, I think in the past we always did the young patient gets an intensive treatment and then intensify it further with an autologous transplant and then use rituximab maintenance. Now I think we're looking at a BTK inhibitor in the induction and consolidation or maintenance phase, and most people are moving away from doing an autologous transplant. And that was further confirmed by the ECOG study, which showed that if you were MRD negative, there was no merit to doing an autologous transplant. So I think most transplanters are actually seeing the number of patients with a mantle cell lymphoma considered for a transplant drop off substantially. And in our practice, I think we've almost gone to next to nobody getting a transplant.
Brian, anything you want to add to that? And also this issue of MRD, could you see intensification of therapy in patients who are MRD positive in general, maybe not just in mantle cell, but in NHL in general, as we're talking about it today? Do you see MRD coming into clinical community-based practice in the near future?
Yeah, what was interesting here in the ECOG trial was that so many patients with standard, whatever they got, that, you know, as their induction, the MRD rates were high, 70 to 80%, which is really nice to see. And the test was reliable. In terms of the outcomes, you know, there were some patients who did get auto transplants for MRD positivity at the end of induction. And a subset of those people did convert to MRD. But again, it doesn't really ask the question whether they would have been just better off going on a BTK inhibitor, which has sort of become our practice. So I love the technology of MRD. I think in a practical sense, we don't really need to know what the results are because really everyone should just get a BTK inhibitor in lieu of transplant, in my view, based on these data.
So speaking of trials that change practice, I guess in this case it changed it by cutting out something we're doing. But right. This trial presented at last year's EHI meeting by Dr. Michael Wong from MD Anderson of Ocala and BR seems to have changed practice in general. Steve, can you talk a little bit about the design of the study, what they saw, and what you think it means?
So I think this was an elderly patient study. Patients got bendamustine rituximab either with a placebo or with a acalabrutinib, and then received a acalabrutinib, and you could add maintenance rituximab to that for the long term afterwards. The outcomes showed that there was a progression-free survival advantage for receiving a acalabrutinib plus bendamustine and rituximab. And to what Brian was saying, that actually has become now, even though this study was specific for elderly patients, many of us are adopting this for younger patients because BR results were pretty good already in the past, and now with acalabrutinib even better, and then using a BTK inhibitor with rituximab as maintenance and no transplant is actually becoming the go-to regimen, certainly in my practice.
So, of course, here's the data in terms of PFS, but also, Steve, you talked about subsets and what they saw there. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, so this was really just to what Brian was saying about MRD positivity versus negativity. And if you just look at the little purple group in the second column in each of the circumstances, these are the people that kind of remained MRD positive at the end of 24 weeks. And you can see that's a very small minority in the patients that got acalabrutinib plus bendamustine rituximab, compared to the placebo BR, which is more. But to what he said is that still in the 70-something percent range that patients that are MRD negative. So it's an effective therapy, bendamustine plus rituximab, made even more effective than with the addition of acalabrutinib. And the acalabrutinib maintenance, I think, really helps for that to be sustained.
So I guess another question is, do you need the bendamustine? And Steve reviewed a paper looking at BTK rituximab, in this case, ibrutinib, in the so-called ENRICHED study. Very encouraging results. But we've also seen data with acalabrutinib and rituximab. Again, this is from the ASH meeting. Dr. Jane, pretty good-looking phase 2 study, but you can see there on the right, the PFS, pretty straight line there. Brian, any thoughts about whether or not we could just go with BTK? I mean, theoretically, I know I've talked to Dr. Wong. He thinks, you know, zanubrutinib might be also equally effective, although I think they've maybe looked more at Acal at MD Anderson. But what about this strategy, Brian? Is it ready for primetime now or maybe in a little bit?
I think it's ready for prime time now in patients with TP53 mutation, where we know that the cytotoxic chemotherapy is adding, you know, basically toxicity without benefit. And so we have different combinations. You can use BTK with rituximab. I think there's the Bovin regimen, which maybe we're talking about later, which is to use zanubrutinib with venetoclax and obinutuzumab, like a triplet for that group. But for the sort of garden variety, non-TP53 mutated, right now in 2025, our practice is still to use bendamustine as long as patients can tolerate it. But for the frail elderly or the TP53 mutated, going straight to a BTK inhibitor, I think, is perfectly reasonable.
So, Steve, what about bringing in venetoclax? This is another study from Dr. Wang looking at acala, ven, and rituximab. Of course, we just saw the big Amplify study in CLL, time-limited acala, ven, that maybe is going to become first-line therapy. And also, Brian mentioned the Bovin study at a Memorial. There, they're using Zanu-Obin, interestingly, and venetoclax high-risk T53-positive, very encouraging results. Again, Steve, any thoughts? And we also saw a paper in relapse mantle cell looking at BTK plus venetoclax, in this case, ibrutinib. So, Steve, again, is venetoclax ready for prime time up front, outside of trial, or maybe in a while?
So I'm not sure that it's ready for prime time up front, but I think certainly in second line, that's a very reasonable, or third line, very reasonable option to consider. I do think that clearly the combination of another agent, be it a CD20 antibody or be it venetoclax with a PTK inhibitor, increases the response rates and the durability of those responses. So I think we're learning a lot from CLL, because a lot of these trends are sort of following what we've done in CLL. And I think we're probably going to be even doing more time-limited kind of therapies in this space as we kind of move forward. But certainly these results make a strong case for the fact that the chemotherapy component is kind of dropping out of the necessity.
So, you know, I just report what people say to me, but sometimes I hear some pretty interesting things, Brian. And I mentioned the fact of, I always love talking to this Dr. Michael Wang that we just talked about from MD Anderson. I always love talking to him. He's usually of course, the maven of mantle cell, but usually a couple years ahead of the rest of us. But I mentioned that we were just at the ONS meeting. We did a program on lymphoma, and we had Chris Flowers there. I just want to show you a very brief interchange we had related to Dr. Wang on frontrino mantle cell.
This has really changed the landscape for patients with mantle cell lymphomas. Ever since I came to MD Anderson in 2019, we've not really used chemotherapy for patients with mantle cell lymphoma. About 60% of our patients go on a clinical trial, so they're on studies like this that Michael has led, looking at here the combination of acalabrutinib, venetoclax, and rituximab. Now we've moved on to pirtobrutinib, venetoclax, and obinutuzumab as combination trials that we're doing for high-risk patients. And then other trials like the one that you saw from Pritesh Jain, his colleague at MD Anderson, who led the work looking at acalabrutinib, rituximab, which has really become our standard of care for older patients with mantle cell lymphoma.
So Steve, he says at MD Anderson they're not using chemo. Any thoughts?
So I think, again, you know, Michael has kind of led the field, and I'll give him kudos to say that because of that, we've kind of learned a lot from him over time. And I would say that if we look at what we've learned so far in the front line, this intensive chemotherapy is clearly not necessary. We just discussed whether we really need bendamustine in front line. I guess there's some questions. And if you just see the data we spoke about in second and subsequent lines, there's not a chemo agent in that combination. So is chemo really necessary? I think you could make the case that it's not clear.
So one final question back to you, Brian, in terms of mantle cell. We hear about TP53, high, Ki-67, blastoid histology, other adverse predictive factors. How adverse are they with the typical therapies? And nowadays, how are you managing these patients?
Yeah, definitely blastoid is still bad no matter what you do. I don't know that the novel agents have solved that problem. TP53, if it's a normal sort of histologic appearance, I think we are kind of able to overcome that high-risk feature by using the targeted agents. And then, of course, in the relapse setting, if they don't get if they're not chemotherapy candidates because of TP53, you still have CAR-T as a sort of subsequent line of therapy, which probably overcomes some of those high-risk features.
And that does lead to the question of patients with relapse disease, Steve. And so, of course, bispecifics right now, there's nothing approved, but we do have some data looking at it. It looks like it responds. I mean, are we going to, if you give a Cala-BR first line, Steve, for eligible patients, is CAR-T next? And how do you get them there? How toxic is CAR-T? Do you see bispecifics coming along and maybe nudging CAR-T away the way it sort of has, from my point of view, from what I've seen in follicular lymphoma?
So I think it's certainly a consideration. I think, to be frank, we're more likely to use a CAR-T in a sort of a third line sort of area, unless the patient has very aggressive disease, rapid relapse, and particularly as Brian was just saying, if they have a blastoid morphology or one of those, I think those are patients where we would consider it. And to your question about toxicity, you know, high numbers of circulating cells are always challenging because those patients do have more toxicity. They actually have more toxicity from bispecifics as well. So that remains a challenging circumstance. If there are ways to decrease the bulk of disease, I think that does also make it a little easier to administer the therapy.
Brian, what about pirtobrutinib? How long are the responses you see and that's from this agent? And, you know, can they maintain patients for a couple of years?
Yeah, pirtobrutinib, for those who aren't familiar, is, you know, a non-covalent BTK inhibitor that is very well, well tolerated and very active in CLL patients who've failed to have durable response to a covalent BTK inhibitor. So there's a classic mutation in cysteine 481, which confers resistance to the covalent BTK inhibitors like Acala and Zanu. And pirtobrutinib works very well for those. Mantle cell is a little more complicated. The resistance mechanisms are not as perhaps straightforward, where they're typically in BTK or PI3 kinase. In CLL, we see different patterns in mantle cell. And although pirtobrutinib is well tolerated and has reasonably good response rates in mantle cell lymphoma, the durability is not overwhelming. And it seems that I view it more as sort of a bridge therapy that we're using as we're lining up, hopefully CAR-T or some clinical trial or something else.
So Steve, Ibuka in the chat room is asking about skin rashes on acalabrutinib. Do you switch to Zanu? But do you see skin rashes with acala, Steve?
So again, I would say I haven't seen that to be a substantial challenge. I'm sure there are some patients that get that. I will be honest and say that zanabrutinib is the agent that I would use more, and I have limited experience with acalabrutinib. I'm not sure that automatically switching to a different BTK inhibitor, I think it's worth a try. I don't know that it's necessarily going to mean that those issues are resolved if it was in any way BTK associated. Brian, I don't know if you've had experience with a lot of rashes.
Yeah, actually, between the two, I think that the rash is more common with zanabrutinib. Certainly any drug can cause rash, but it's not a common toxicity that we see with acalabrutinib. We're more familiar with the headache that's fairly common but manageable. So overall, I think they're both pretty well tolerated. And when I have had rashes with one, and if I think the patient's responding, then I will often switch just sort of empirically and often do see resolution of the toxicity, including rash.
So let's talk a little bit about follicular lymphoma. I was just mentioning we did this two-hour program just on relapse follicular lymphoma. If you imagine, we could talk about that for 2 hours, but we did, and it was all really interesting, including a couple of studies that you talked about, Steve, that I don't know, I was kind of surprised. You know, we mentioned TAFA and diffuse large B-cell, and then boom, all of a sudden it pops up with follicular being added to R-squared, and they had pretty impressive results as you go through in your talk. The other sort of surprise to me is, again, I always associated LONCA-T with diffuse large B-cell, but here we saw data with follicular that also looks pretty encouraging. Steve, any thoughts about these two agents in follicular?
So I think one of the things that's always encouraging about follicular lymphoma is that it's very, very typical that patients will benefit and respond to many agents. And I think, again, these are two agents where we see either on their own or in combinations we see really high response rates. I think what's also encouraging is that the responses here look quite durable. And I think the point being with loncastuximab tesirine, that it's how well tolerated it is, how well tolerated is it if you keep going for a long period of time? I think that's a bit of a challenge sometimes. I think the tafasitamab with R squared, the results actually are good because R squared is a very standard approach, and tafasitamab added to that, I think, is a logical combination, and again with pretty good efficacy.
Yeah. So let's talk about I'm sorry, go ahead, Ryan.
I was just going to say that what really shows that, again, you're talking about two agents targeting CD19 in Lonca-T and Tafa, and really revealing that the data with Lonca-T and rituximab are pretty spectacular. And then the data of adding tafasitamab to R-squared really shows additive benefit. So multiple targets, and in both cases, not really excessive toxicity.
Steve, also, we didn't talk about it, but there was a paper at ASH looking at zanubrutinib with obinutuzumab. Again, a little bit of a surprise. I never really figured out whether BTK fits into lymphoma, but there all of a sudden, I don't know how much of it was the obinutuzumab. Any thoughts about that combination, Steve?
Yeah, so I think that, again, was really encouraging data and a little bit different to what we had seen with BTK inhibitors in follicular lymphoma in general. I would, however, say that, initially, when the studies with BTK inhibitors were done, I think the expectation was that it was going to be highly effective in follicular lymphoma. And I think many of us were surprised when it was a little less effective. But clearly, when you modulate the environment within the tumor using a antibody targeting CD20, you may well change things and allow for BTK inhibition then to actually have additional benefits. So I think all of this is just to say that there's that is really an encouraging progress in follicular lymphoma, and hopefully will actually result in something that we can continue to build on.
So, Brian, back to bispecifics. I was just flashing this morning. I was working with Dr. Harrison for their myelofibrosis program next week, and she told me about a CD30 bispecific to CALR in myelofibrosis. So maybe they're going to end up, there's also an antibody to CALR. I don't think there's any data of any of these things, but
yeah,
bispecifics are popping up all over the place where you wouldn't expect it. But let's talk about in follicular lymphoma, starting out with the mosunetuzumab that we talked about earlier in terms of who or how it can be given. Anything you want to say about what patients go through with these two and epcoritamab? Also, we didn't say too much about odronextamab, which is not approved in the United States, although it is approved in Europe, Brian, and whether you see that also coming on board in the United States. The data kind of looks pretty similar. So any sort of general thoughts about that, Brian?
I mean, the general thoughts for follicular lymphoma is that we do now have two approved agents with mosunetuzumab and epcoritamab. Both look like they give, very high response rates, high CRs, and pretty durable responses. As far as odronextamab goes, it's not yet FDA approved in the United States. It's probably coming. It's not clear that it's superior in any way, but it's something that's probably going to continue to crowd the landscape in the not too distant future. I think this data is really interesting to see those MRD negative patients have really spectacular results on the far right.
So we're going to get into CAR T in a second, but Steve, anything else you want to say about bispecifics and what patients typically go through? And for the mosunetuzumab, how long they're on treatment?
Yeah, so I think in general, once you've managed the initial kind of few weeks, I think patients actually will tolerate it pretty well. I think in general, the challenge is just that when you get out many months, patients find it a little frustrating, especially in our practice where they often are coming from a substantial distance to receive treatment. And that's, again, to the point we made right in the beginning. Partnering with practices closer to home is kind of one of the things that's really important. And then I think obviously monitoring for infectious complications over time, because I do think that's one of the things that impacts patients a lot. And I think that's really relevant in follicular lymphoma. You know, if you look at patients that do well for a two-year period, the POD24 achieved patients, the people that don't progress, those people have a similar outcome to the national average. So you want to be a little careful not to hurt them with a lot of infectious problems, which may shorten their lives when the outcome was actually going to be very good.
So, Brian, what kind of infections do you see specifically in this situation? And what about response to vaccines?
Yeah, so the most common types of infections we see in the kind of B-cell depleted patients after CAR T or bispecific would be like the prolonged sinus, sinonasal kind of infections that just linger and linger and require multiple rounds of antibiotics. But we've also seen CMV reactivation and other viral reactivations. So it's not a trivial consideration. And of course, you are talking about often patients who are elderly, maybe in their 60s, 70s, have comorbidities and often have had prior exposure to chemotherapies. So it has the cumulative effect of really sometimes years of immunosuppression, which can really have a negative impact on patients' quality of life.
So let's talk a little bit about CAR T and follicular lymphoma. Steve, I mean, we're talking about follicular, not transformed disease here. And Brian went through the data with Lysocell, where we see the Transcend, the 2-year follow up data are pretty encouraging. Also with Tisocell, again, the ALARA study. Seeing good effects in terms of progression-free survival. Steve, can you talk a little bit about, first of all, how often you use it? How many times in the last year you've sent a patient with FL for a CAR T, and what your preference is in terms of the specific type of CAR T?
So I do think these CAR Ts, particularly the two you highlight here, have a slower activation because of the 4-1BB activation motif. So I think that's a good thing because I think the very rapid progression or activation obviously puts patients at a risk for more toxicities. So that's actually something that's well tolerated, reasonably tolerated in this circumstance. I will say though that if I look at who we are considering for CAR T for follicular lymphoma, I think it's those patients that we really struggle to get into a good remission, and we're seeing progressing kind of right off the bat with therapy. Patients that have a very good response to the first line and then a very good response to a subsequent line, as you pointed out, that's a crowded space with lots of active agents, we tend to be a little less likely to reach for CAR T in the responding and durably responding patients. So it's really those patients with aggressive behaving CAR T, or aggressive behaving follicular lymphomas that we would give CAR T to.
So one final point, and this is about marginal zone lymphoma that Brian brought up in his talk. It sounds like there was a press release that came out in February looking at Lysocell and marginal zone lymphoma. Looks positive. I don't know, maybe next year's year in review, we'll be reviewing the data from that one, Brian. But any thoughts about where this is going to fit in terms of marginal zone lymphoma, Brian?
Yeah, similar to Steve's point about FL, I think marginal zone tends to be indolent, tends to do well, but when it doesn't, it can go south quickly. And we do see patients, they, you know, are behaving as if they've got a transformed aggressive large B-cell lymphoma, and you get biopsies and you can't really prove it, but it just feels that way. Short remissions, inadequate response to therapy. And right now, actually, despite all the things we've been talking about, there is no approved CAR T available for marginal zone lymphoma. So I think we'll probably see this sometime this summer. And when we see the data, if it's good enough to get an approval, that would be a really welcome thing for patients with this disease.
Steve, anything you want to add to that?
No, I think it's exactly right. We'd love to see an additional tool in the toolbox for marginal zone lymphoma, and this would be a very valuable asset, particularly for those rapidly early progressing kind of patients.
So, Steve and Brian, thank you so much for working with us today. We all learned a lot. Thanks to everyone for attending. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Steve. Thanks so much, Brian. Have a good one.
All right. Thanks so much. Take care.
Thank you.